Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
And welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Long before Mad Men and Breaking Bad, network TV sitcoms like The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Maude, and The Bob Newhart Show were tackling previously taboo issues like mental illness, birth control for unmarried women, and female characters who choose to stay single. They were written by people like today's guest, Susan Silver, women who dared to break into the industry that was overwhelmingly dominated by men. Ms. Silver's new memoir, Hot Pants in Hollywood, Sex, Secrets, and Sitcoms, recounts her experiences as the writer of many episodes of a host of iconic sitcoms, as well as movie scripts, theater books, and a blog called The Search for Mr. Adequate. She was also a casting director at Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, a UN observer for the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and an early and enthusiastic supporter of Bill Clinton. She's now the host of Susan Says, a weekly commentary on politics, media, and culture that's broadcast on the Robin Hood Radio NPR stations in Sharon, Connecticut. I'm very pleased to welcome Susan Silver to our show now. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. I'm calling to make a pledge. I can't talk to you right now.
You've worked in media in both California and New York. Do they differ much?
Oh, totally. Everything is different between California and New York. The way I say it is when you come out to L.A., you call your friends, you say, hi, I'm here. And they say, oh, we'll get back to you. And then like in a month, you hear from them. And then you have to drive somewhere. In New York, they say, what are you doing now? Meet me at such and such. And that's it.
Uh-huh. So you prefer New York?
Yeah.
But you were born in between both. Weren't you born into a family in Milwaukee, but family that had deep roots in show business?
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. People confuse it with Minneapolis and Mary. It's almost the same, but it's smaller.
It's where beer is made.
It's where beer is made, and I don't drink it. And it's where cheese is made, and I have like a lactose intolerance or something, so I had to get out of there. My uncle was Cy Howard. My mother's brother was a very well-known comedy writer back in the day. He started Martin and Lewis, and That's My Boy, and he had a couple other shows. And
didn't he do the Smothers Brothers?
He did later. He was a consultant on the Smothers Brothers, but his claim to fame was he wrote for Eddie Cantor, whom I met when I was a child, and he came to Milwaukee and brought showbiz into my life.
And is that when you decided that you wanted to have a career of your own in show business?
Probably had some influence. He also was married to Gloria Graham, the lovely, wonderful noir film actress. I think I always wanted to write. I just wasn't sure what I wanted to write, and he made it easier being out in California.
And when did you write your first script?
I was in television production and casting. And I was working on Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, and I wanted to be a writer, but they wouldn't let women be writers because they said that the guys were working in an apartment. They wanted to wear their underwear and, how can I say this nicely, pass gas. Mm-hmm. And so
you would make them uptight if a woman were present.
Right. So I had a partner at the time named Iris Rayner Dart, who was managed by the late, great Gary Marshall. And she would come into my office, and we wrote a Love American Style together. Gary taught us how to do that. And then we wrote a That Girl. And then the Mary Tyler Moore Show came on, and Iris took a break to have a baby. And I said, I want to write that show.
But even earlier, you were writing in college, weren't you?
Yes.
And didn't you act in a college sketch with Mary Fran, who played the wife of Bob Newhart in the second Newhart series?
Oh, you read my book, or someone did, yes. Mary Fran, who was a lovely person. We were both showgirls at Northwestern in a show called WAMU. And I was a freshman showgirl, which was kind of fun. And I realized doing that there was no way I wanted to be an actress, even though I had been an extra in the movies.
You were always in bikinis,
yeah,
as an extra.
I was in bikinis. That's how I met Steve McQueen. But let's not talk about that right now. I wrote this sketch, And I heard the laughter as I was mouthing the words with the performers. I said, ah, this is what I want to do. I want to be a comedy writer.
Did you move in with your Uncle Cy when you went to California?
Being an only child from a very protective family, I was only allowed to go as far as Northwestern my first 2 years. My parents wanted me to stay in the house, but I thought it would be better to go to college. And then my uncle said, okay, you can live with me. And that was what allowed my parents to allow me to escape to California.
And he protected you in a way. He tried to keep his wild parties hidden.
Yes.
There were lots of famous people coming and going and doing things that newspapers in those days wouldn't report on?
No, I think Confidential Magazine would have reported. Uh-huh. Yes, my uncle was kind of a playboy and man about town, and I was in my wing, but I did smell something which later probably was known to be marijuana, but I'm not sure.
So you spent the summers in L.A. rather than going home to Wisconsin. What did you do to earn money?
I wanted to stay in L.A. because I didn't want to go home, so I became an extra. I applied to the Extra Guild, and my uncle was very upset because my mother didn't want me to go into showbiz, and she would blame him, and so she did. But I became an extra in the movies and TV, which was great fun.
Beach Blanket Bingo?
Yes, I was in a couple Beach Blanket, because I learned how to do the twist from watching American Bandstand at home and Dancing with the Door by myself. So then I put that to work in college, and I was asked to teach Steve McQueen how to do the twist. So I had to go into his trailer, and I had a little bikini on, and he barely looked up.
Mm-hmm.
But later, it's in the book.
But the twist is not the hardest thing in the world to learn.
Well, it
That's
is if
why
your top doesn't work with your bottom well. You have to learn how to coordinate it.
And then at one point you dated Lenny Bruce? That must have been a wild thing.
I can't say I dated. What happened was I went to a New Year's Eve party, and his mother, who was a renowned woman and former
stripper,
I didn't want to say it, but
it's okay.
Okay.
The stripper's allowed.
Said,
it's not one of the words the FCC doesn't allow us to say.
Okay, well, you better watch me because I'm probably going to say some. Anyway, she said, are you single? And I said, yes. She said, I'd like to introduce you to my son. I said, who's your son? She said, Lenny Bruce. And I'm at this New Year's Eve party. I thought, Lenny Bruce has nothing better to do than come to a college party? Oh, okay. So he came in, and he was sexy and fabulous and brilliant. And he asked me to come to his show at the Crescendo. And so I asked my uncle, and my uncle said, hell no. And I said, I'm going. And my uncle said, well, I'm going with you. So Lenny Bruce, my uncle, and I had a date.
So Cy Howard chaperoned you?
Yes, and he and Lenny got along great. I was terrified.
How old were you at the time?
I must have been 19 or 20.
And Lenny was a lot older at that point.
He was. And then, sad to say, about 2 months later, he died of an overdose. And
Is late in his life.
Yeah, and he was dating another Jewish comedian, Lotus Weinstock. So it could have been me. It would have been awful.
What, you mean being there when he died?
Yeah.
I know somebody else who dated him years before when he was going through all of his troubles with the law.
Yes.
And she said he was a handful, but maybe you met him when he had mellowed a bit.
He was a fabulous guy. He was very soulful. I felt I could take care of him and save him. It just shows you. And then just a year or two ago, I was invited to come to Brandeis. His daughter was opening an exhibit 50 years later of his papers, and I had asked to come, and they said, why? And I said, well, I knew him. So they asked me to talk at this First Amendment, brilliant, you know, intellectual thing, academic, and I was talking about how his mother fixed me up with him. It was weird.
But on the other hand, you have to feel proud that you met a man who really changed the course of American comedy. After Lenny, there's comedy before Lenny Bruce and comedy after Lenny
and
Bruce.
Also Mort Saul. There was a troika at the time, you know, Shelley Berman, Mort Saul, who I worked for as an associate producer of his talk show.
And you had to find guests on that show?
I did. I had to find guests. And then I was there for, I'm going to say, like 5 months. And in the 5 months I was there, someone ahead of me was fired every month, and I became the producer, which is bizarre.
But then you got yourself fired.
Yes. I didn't get my... What happened was I looked out the window, my car was being towed, and Mort was talking, and instead of listening, I ran out to rescue my car, and when I came back, all my things were on the stoop of the place, and I had been fired. But he and I became friends after, but it was weird.
You also was supervised and writing a script by Francis Ford Coppola, one of the nicest people I've ever met, by the way. You were in graduate school, and you wrote a script called How Lucky We Are. What was that about?
It was about my interracial dating, and Francis was my graduate student teacher, and he had a seminar for
us.
Was
he a good teacher?
He was a wonderful teacher, and he really cared about us. He had us over to his home. He treated us beautifully. And my script won. I was the youngest person to win a Writers Guild Award for that script that he sort of mentored me through, yeah.
At the time that you wrote the script, you were dating Van Whitfield, African-American director and the future head of the National Endowment of the Arts. I'm assuming that the script was based to some degree on your personal experiences?
Yes.
But meanwhile, were all your jobs connected to show business, the secretarial jobs and the like?
Yes. When I first got out of college, I couldn't get a job because I didn't have shorthand. I refused to take shorthand, and I couldn't type. And then, of course, I couldn't get a job, and my mother said, I told you so. So I had to take speed writing, which was this thing where I couldn't read the speed writing.
And now most of the speed writing is the way people write their tweets, U as the letter U, the number
no,
two.
No, it was symbols of things. I couldn't read. I was working at a small TV station. I could not read my letters, but I was working for a really old guy who couldn't remember what he had said. So I wrote the letters on my own. And then I had to have somebody help me. In those days, there were like these balls in the typewriter that you had to change, and I couldn't do that either.
I guess you weren't prepared for
life.
For the secretarial life, which probably all worked on your behalf. You were also a casting director for Rowan and Martin's Laugh, and didn't you book then presidential candidate Richard Nixon?
I didn't book him, but I had to have his contract signed. We had most of the writing team and production team were liberals, but we had one closet Republican named Paul Keyes who was working with Roger Ailes. And Roger Ailes, back in the day, worked for Richard Nixon, and his job was to make him more human since he wore a suit on the beach with shoes and socks. And so we thought we were having this coup of getting him there to say "sock it to me." All people were brought on the show to say "sock it to me," and then people would throw water on them. So we had a promise not to throw water. But he was supposed to say "sock it to me" as a question, and it took six takes. But I went into the makeup room. He was having his makeup put on. I thought if I could just get them to not do his makeup, he would look like he did during the debate, but I couldn't. But he was very nice.
And he wound up winning the election, to some degree humanized. Some people complained by the "sock it to me."
We either were blamed or criticized, but then we were on the FBI list afterward.
J. Edgar Hoover, you say, himself answered inquiries from people who complained about the politics of the show?
Yeah, we were a very political show ahead of our time, we and the Smothers Brothers, and we found out afterward that in spite of the fact that we got him elected, we were on the FBI list.
But it was when you were at Laugh-In, when you tried to get become a writer, and that's when you were told that they wanted to wear their underwear and pass gas. You write that the only downside to working on Laugh-In was the way some women treated other women.
Sad to say, I have had two bad experiences in my career with women, believe it or not, who, as I say in the book, what happened in this case was there were so few women in television production that when one achieved a certain level of power and it was difficult for her, she didn't want to make it too easy on the next generation. I actually got an ulcer during that time because the woman was so mean to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, the
I won't name names, but she knows who she is.
Let's hope she's listening and is feeling guilty. I'm speaking to Susan Silvers about her memoir, Hot Pants in Hollywood, Sex, Secrets, and Sitcoms. This is Leonard Lopit at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Also, just recorded an audiobook version of this.
I was so excited. I did the Audible version of my book. I hadn't listened a lot to Audible books, but everybody's listening to it. And you can either hire an actress or do it yourself. And I did it myself. It was the most fun thing because I really felt I could connect with the readers like I was talking to a friend. So you can pre-order it now, people. It's lots of fun, I promise.
But you've had experience in radio and you worked with so many actors over the years. I assume that it was a lot easier for you to understand what you had to do than it might have been for somebody who has just been sitting in a dark room for years and typing away.
Well, you know, as they say in comedy and in life, everything is timing. And so I had the timing to read the chapters. When I got to the sad things about my parents passing and illnesses, that was hard. I actually started to cry, so I had to stop. But it's a wonderful thing to read your own. And I don't see how anybody could hire someone else to read their memoir. It's like weird.
Well, some people read very poorly.
Right.
We've come to the point where you got married. Was that one of the happier things or one of the sadder things?
It was very happy. In fact, I have to tell you, whenever I do an interview, particularly with men who have read the book, they'll say, "Aren't you sorry you left Arthur? He's such a great guy." So I called him. I said, "Honey, everybody loves you." He said, "Well, maybe you made me too nice." I mean, my husband was a wonderful guy, still is, and we just grew apart. Or to put it really truthfully, I grew and he stayed the exact same way. So
you mentioned that you started writing for TV, teamed up with Iris Rayner, and you pitched scripts to TV producers. Did you have some disturbing experience when you were doing that? How did they react to these two women coming in and pitching ideas at that time?
You know, the interesting thing was because I came at the beginning of feminism, it was kind of a help in some ways, but they weren't quite ready. We had two bad experiences. One guy said, "Are you the two secretaries?" I said, "No, we're the writers." And he put his feet up on the desk in our faces. And we called him Feet from then on. The other guy, we walked into his office. Should I name name? Probably not. But he had a wall full of breasts, of pictures of breasts from Playboy magazine, and we had to pitch directly to that. One of us started to cry. I'm not going to say which one. And then from then on, I took a bottle of Mylanta with me and I put it on the desk each time I had a meeting so they'd feel sorry for me.
And I'll name that guy, James Comeck.
Right.
He was the producer of the TV series The Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Right. This lovely warm thing about a man and his child, and he had a wall of breasts.
So what were your feelings about feminism at that time? Because you write about wearing hot pants and miniskirts.
I have to apologize to Gloria Steinem and everybody else about the hot pants. It wasn't my attitude. I didn't have that attitude. It was what I wore. So I'd like to make that distinction. But it was something I just did because we wore them. And it got me a lot of publicity, got me a TV Guide article. And
even before you started major breakthrough?
Just as I started, it was called The Writer Wore Hot Pants, and the subtitle was, "You're not going to make $3,500 just because you have good legs." So it was kind of a in-your-face and yet good-timing thing. I think because of the Mary Tyler Moore Show actively looking for women and wanting us and hiring me as my first solo script, I started on top, and I didn't have a lot of the problems that other people did. I was very fortunate.
But even before then, Bernie Weintraub was your agent for a while, and you say he was one of the good guys.
Yeah.
He got you interviews that you might not have gotten otherwise?
Well, I think, frankly, Gary Marshall being my mentor and backing me, he promised the guys at MTM that he would back me. I had never written a script on my own. He really opened the door to everything.
And the first show you were hired as a writer was a kid show?
Iris and I did a script for a show called Lancelot Link. Two of the guys that were writers at Laugh-In did this show. It was an animated show about, no, it wasn't animated. It was a show about monkeys being spies. I don't know how they did it.
Using real chimps.
Real monkeys were on skis and stuff. It's very cute.
And you wrote the pilot.
Not for that.
Oh.
We just wrote a script for it.
And was it ever made?
Yes. And do I get reruns?
Well,
no.
Well,
we don't get reruns.
Well, I don't think I've ever heard of Lancelot Link's Secret Agent.
It's on like YouTube somewhere or something.
Well, you didn't have to write lines for the chimps, so how much writing did you actually have to do?
We wrote the story, and we wrote the moves, chimp skis in. I don't recall.
You pitched a script for That Girl, which starred Marlo Thomas, who was also the executive producer of her show. And they bought the script, but the episode you wrote was never produced.
Yeah, this is something that happens quite a bit. Marlo at the time was a feminist and a leader and the executive producer, and our script was about her marrying Donald, the boyfriend, and she decided she wanted to keep her single, so our script was bought, paid for, but never shot. Unfortunately, there's something in showbiz called development hell, where you write things, you get paid, and they never get made, and they're lined up on shelves. It's kind of sad.
So there were people who make nice money and nothing ever gets produced?
Yeah, I was one of the most successful people. I wrote 15 pilots, none got made. I wrote 16 movies the week, two got made, and we're top 10. And I still couldn't get the other 14 made. Yeah, after 20 years, it gets to you, which is one of the reasons I retired.
Didn't you write a script for Love American Style?
I did with Iris. That was our first.
And what was that about?
That was about a couple meeting to cheat. Mm. And get it. It was called Love in the Afternoon, and it was sort of based on something in my life.
Oh, well, we did talk about the marriage falling apart. but it must have been exciting to see your name on the screen. Was it... At the beginning of the show and the end, or just at the end?
No, it was just one place. I can't remember. I think at the beginning. It was very exciting. At Laugh-It, it went by so quickly in the casting, but in the writing of a script, your name was up there, and it was very exciting. Every show, it was exciting. It never got less exciting.
Throughout the book, you mentioned projects that never got made. What does that do to a writer? Does it take the wind out of your sails?
You know, I was married at the time, so I was very fortunate. I didn't have to write to earn a living. I wrote because I loved writing, and you pour your heart and soul into something, even a half hour, but particularly a movie of the week. I did five features also. And it's a terrible analogy, but it feels like having a lot of little dead babies on a shelf. It's a very debilitating thing. And as I say, after 20 years, I literally had to get out of the business because it was very upsetting.
What kinds of things did you write for Movie of the Week?
Oh, gosh.
Not the same sorts of things you were writing for the sitcoms.
No, I wrote a couple things based on books. My favorite one was What Are You Doing New Year's Eve, which is about five women dating married men and being together on New Year's Eve. That didn't get made. A lot didn't. The two that got made were both top 10 movies, one starring Karen Valentine, the girl who came gift-wrapped, and the other one, Bill Bixby, being my husband, essentially. There was an article in Ms. Magazine called If I Had a Wife. Back in the day, if you were a working woman, you wanted a wife, so it's called The Couple Takes a Wife, and it was really about my life.
So you were not being overlooked.
That
must have helped you when you went to pitch a script.
Oh, yeah. I sold things all the time. I was busy all the time. I made a lot of money. But as I say, this terrible thing of it not getting made, it wears you down.
And then early in this process, your writing partner, Iris Rayner got pregnant and took a break. And then you were on your own. So how did that affect you?
Well, as I say, Gary, if I didn't have Gary to back me, it would have been a nightmare. But I saw the Mary Tyler Moore show, and I was so fortunate that my life kind of paralleled her life. I was from Milwaukee. She was from Minneapolis. I was working in a small TV station. So was she. So it gave me the opportunity. I told Gary, this is a show I can write. And as I say, I started on top. It was downhill for the next 20 years.
But Iris Rayner, or Iris Rayner Dart at this point, had some success on her own.
Oh, she went on to be very successful.
She wrote a novel called Beaches that was made into a popular movie starring Bette Midler and Barbara Hershey.
Right, and Gary directed it.
Gary
Marshall.
And
she's doing it as a musical now for Broadway.
Did you ever discuss teaming up again?
No, we're friends all this time, though. We still make each other laugh, and we're still in each other's lives.
Now, you mentioned Gary Marshall. He is... was first known as the brother of actress Penny Marshall, became her manager, but then he went on to have an incredible career of his own. He's a film director, a producer, a screenwriter. He's done acting. Did all that come later?
No, actually, the Penny thing came after, because she was just starting out. She was actually in one of my movies of the week in a very small part. Gary started with a partner named Jerry Belson, and they wrote for Danny Thomas and a lot of people. And he and the most successful things he did were Happy Days and The Odd Couple for television. And then he started this company for his father to sponsor writers and mentor people.
And was he supportive? I found him absolutely charming when I interviewed him.
Oh, you did? Oh, he was my best friend in the world, and he passed, as we know, a couple years ago. I loved Gary. He was my mentor. My claim to fame with him is, he said, there are only two people in the world that drove him crazy, his mother and me.
And me is Susan Silver. We are talking about her memoir called Hot Pants in Hollywood: Sex, Secrets, and Sitcoms. So let's talk about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. You got an interview with Alan Burns and Jim Brooks, who produced it. And this obviously, even though you'd been doing stuff, this was your big break?
Yeah, because it was the first time I was pitching alone. I had been with Iris for the other two jobs. It was a new show that hadn't been picked up yet. And at the time, because I didn't know a lot, I thought that you weren't allowed to make things up, so I only went in with stories from my own life. I went in with five stories to pitch, and they thought I was like a genius. Any woman could have pitched those stories, but they were stories that guys don't think about. So they had one woman there, Treva Silverman, and they wanted more.
And the rest of the writers were men?
Yeah. And they said, if we get picked up, because they started mid-season, you'll be the first hire. And I pitched my stories, and they picked one, and I was.
The first episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show aired in 1971. Why was the show so important at that time?
Well, it was at the beginning of feminism. It was breakthrough in that it was the first time a sort of female character, other than that girl, who wanted her life and had a career and wasn't just looking to get married. And the pilot, as you may or may not recall, was Mary's fiancé had dumped her and she moved to Minneapolis. And it was just such great synchronicity with feminism, and we both helped each other, I think.
You don't mention the Mustang, but who decided to put her in a Mustang, a classic male car?
Oh, I don't know. What's a classic female car? I thought a Corvette was a male car.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
It's longer.
I don't want to get into this debate here.
Whoops.
The show was one of the first sitcoms to be written with the help of a team of women writers. How many women were working on it when it was at its height?
You know, I don't know, but a lot. I want to say like 17, but I could be wrong.
I think that's the number. That's a lot.
So,
not all at once. You weren't all sitting around a room.
See, we didn't have a writer's room in the day. That's one of my pet peeves now for several reasons. Back in the day, you went into the two producers and two story editors. You pitched your script. They worked with you if they liked it for a half day. They worked a whole day. Other shows, you'd go in, they'd give you 20 minutes. Then you'd go home and you'd write it. Now they're all in a room together, and I don't consider it writing. I consider it spritzing.
Yeah, but they were already doing that before, because you mentioned that male writers didn't want female
writers.
That was
on a variety show. Sitcoms, you went home, you wrote your own script, your own name was on it. Now they're sitting in writers' rooms. I wouldn't want to do it, because it's competitive with each other.
And it's been said that what women brought to the characters and their scripts was intimate dialogue about their jobs and relationships, things that men might not have really been all that privy to.
Well, just even little things. I talk about this because it's a small thing, but it's so evocative of it. At one point they said, then Mary goes and gets cleaned up. I said, no, women don't get cleaned up.
What do they mean by cleaned up?
Take a bath, take a shower. You know, we don't get cleaned up. Boys do. So, you know, little things like that brought the feminine touch. Girls sit and write their name and what their married name is going to be and doodle it on a paper. And my first character was called Twinks, and she was marrying a guy named Arnold Tvet. So her name was going to be Twinks Tvet. And she kept writing that.
But that
note.
Was mean of you.
No, it was a real person.
Oh.
My husband and I went to look for a house, and the realtor's name was Arnold Tvet. I said, this is such a great name. I had a scene which had to be cut because of time, but you can't kill that name with a stick. If you take out the E, it's still Tvet. If you take out the D, it's still Tvet. It's just Tvet.
Women of a certain generation talk about having a Mary Tyler Moore moment. Why do you think this show had such an impact on young women?
Well, first of all, she was extraordinarily likable. Men wanted to date her, and women wanted to be her. She could get away with things that Rhoda couldn't or that other kinds of characters couldn't. And as I say, it was just the timing. Now, I know Gloria Steinem confronted Jim Brooks at some point and said it wasn't feminist enough, but it wasn't a message show. Norman Lear's shows were message shows. Gary Marshall's shows were, like he said, recess in the day. Our show was very just realistic of things that women were doing in their lives that hadn't been seen before on television.
The thing that made Norman Lear so successful was that he had message shows that still were funny. And in the end, all of these shows had to be funny. So
one would hope.
So, well, Mary Tyler Moore had its laughs, and I don't know whether they had a laugh track or whether
it was an audience. You can always hear Jim Brooks had a very iconic laugh. It's a kind of a high-pitched owl-like thing. It's still on there, yeah.
So were you good at writing jokes, or was that the time when you turned to your writing partner and said, okay, where'd we,
I didn't have a partner. I had to turn to myself. Actually, I wasn't as good at jokes as I was at character and story. It's interesting you say that.
Often the humor grows out of the character and story.
Well, it's called sitcom, don't forget. Mm-hmm. It's a situation comedy. It's not spritzing. It's not jokes, stand-up. And I was very good at story and character, but I'm also funny. So I guess I could do all.
What was the situation in the first episode you wrote for the Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Every woman has had this happen to her, where you have to stand up for a wedding for someone you don't love tremendously, and then you have to wear this hideous dress. So in my thing, it was the new receptionist was a girl called Twinks that Mary had gone to camp with and had no recollection of, and this girl was overly friendly and chose Mary to be her maid of honor and Rhoda to be a bridesmaid. And the dresses were like Bo Peep. All that was missing was the sheep and the crook. You know, there were these hideous dresses. And the costume department did a brilliant job. And when Mary came out in that dress, I think it was one of the longest laughs they've ever had sustained.
Which I'm assuming then made them want you to write more scripts.
Yes, because they liked that. They immediately hired me to do...
How many do you remember how many you did?
A multiple. Yeah, I did two more then, and then I did two more after that. But in my second year, I was extremely fortunate. I was doing pilots and movies of the week, and I stopped doing episodes. And the weird thing is, we only got 10 reruns back in the day. We went on strike later for more, so I don't get... All these shows you see that are on, reruns, I don't get any money, but they're still alive.
If you'd written them today, you would have made a lot more.
A lot.
Lorenzo Music was a story editor at Mary Tyler Moore. Didn't he have a cameo role in the spin-off series Rhoda?
He was the doorman. His voice was the doorman. He was
Carlton
the doorman. And he and David Davis were the story editors, and so unbelievably kind and helpful to me and made it very much easier.
And he warmed up the audiences?
Yeah. He was a funny guy.
Were you in the audience when episodes you wrote were being taped?
Yes, you went to the tapings, and the incredible thing was they introduced you. And, I mean, for good or for bad, that's what happened. When they first introduced me, they said something about my legs, which is why TV Guide picked up on it. So,
were you surprised when many years later Mary Tyler Moore talked about her great friendship with Newt Gingrich? You didn't know that?
Oh, I didn't. Shock on my face. I just, what?
She definitely made a big thing about it, and I asked her whether Lou Grant would have approved.
Shut my mouth. Well, you know, I wound up living in New York two doors from Mary, and so that was kind of amazing anyway. Had I known that, I find him the sort of father of this disgusting partisanism. And years later, I was dating a congressman, and I got into the elevator in the Capitol, and he was in the elevator, and I got out as my own personal protest. So,
of Newt Gingrich, well, after I interviewed him years ago, he sent me a Christmas card every year for quite a few years, and then one year I didn't receive it, and I realized he was running for president again, and so he no longer was going to send me any.
There's a man whose name suits him. He's a Newt.
Gingrich? Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Was writing for the Mary Tyler Moore different from writing for, let's say, the Partridge Family or Square Pegs?
Yeah. The thing about sitcom writing is it's really radio. I mean, because it's really all about the ear. You have to learn that Rhoda sounds different than Lou and Mary sounds different than Shirley did in Partridge. You have to be a good mimic. And once you get the voices on the show, you can kind of plug into any show.
So you could these shows have functioned as radio shows? Because sitcoms really grow out of all the popular radio shows of the 30s and 40s.
Sure. Like I say, my uncle did two shows, Life with Luigi and My Friend Irma, back in the day, and they were radio shows. Yeah, because, you know, you're in one set. In fact, Iris and I knew so little. One time we were working with Gary, and we were writing a script. It was going to be for Odd Couple, and we said, and then the bus comes through. And he said, we're on a stage. There's no bus. It's not coming anywhere.
Well, they could have just
well, if
put
it's
something
a film
on the
show,
screen.
If it's a film show, they do it. But three-camera shows in the studio, you don't go out to the bus.
And I'm assuming that also affected the way you thought of writing a script, because it was kind of limiting, but maybe also more intimate.
Well, it wasn't so much even a question. I think the main thing you had to know was not to change what the creators wanted. Like, one of the rules, there were rules I didn't know. I broke the first rule. You usually write a show that has to do with the main characters, and it is called The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mine was about an outside character. That's a rule. I mean, there are rules that you abide, and you don't change the attitudes of the characters the first year. Much later on, because Mary was so perfect and everything was wonderful, they did a show where everything fell apart on her. So then you can change it, but you don't go and pitch something that's so different from what the creators intended.
You write that, I'm quoting, the hardest, most frightening part of writing a sitcom is the empty first page.
Yes, it is. And so there are two tricks I tell when I teach writing. I tell people, when you're working, the good thing to do is just write down anything. I mean, I say, and then she says something. Mm-hmm. And then just keep going, because there are certain writers that work line by line. I could never do that. I'd never get past the first line. And then the second tip is, at night when you're really doing well, stop in the middle of the scene, because then in the morning you can pick up where you left off and you don't have to face that empty page again.
So you don't just sit down and write a whole 30-minute episode.
No, you have, don't forget, you go and you pitch a story. With a good show, they work out the story beats with you. You go home with an outline. You turn in the outline. They okay it or not.
So how long does the studio allow you to do all of this?
Well, it depends on how fast you are. I was extremely fast. I would write a script in 3-4 days, but it just depends on how many assignments. Don't forget now, as I say, they're in that writer's room, so they're all working together and walking in and out of the same room. I don't know how they can do it.
Some other advice that you give to potential TV writers in the book, you say that if you want to write for a particular show, send a sample script for an entirely different show. I would have thought you'd send one on the show that you're trying to write for.
No, because don't forget, they know their own show best. If you want to write for Veep, which is a brilliant show in my mind, it's the greatest show on now, you don't send them one because they know it better. Pick another show that's funny and show that you can write what the others want, and then they'll hope you can do it for them.
Besides besides the obvious, how does writing a sitcom differ from writing a drama, other than the fact that you have jokes?
That's the number one way. Uh-huh. Well, first of all, you know, an hour is different than a half hour. Most dramas are hours. Some of the movies of the week I wrote were drama. My award-winning screenplay was a drama.
What was your award-winning screenplay?
How Lucky We Are.
Oh,
that
yeah,
I wrote
that
in
early
college.
One.
Yeah, obviously, it's harder to write comedy. If you're not funny, you know, it's tough. Get a partner who's funny.
And dramas are driven by action, while sitcoms are driven by the characters?
Both. I think good dramas are both character and story.
Were you drawing, you drew upon your life for a number of things. Did friends and family recognize themselves in some of these stories?
Yes. Well, when I did the first Maud, it was easy because my mother was kind of like Maud. And the story I pitched was Carol, the daughter, wants to go to therapy. And Maud says, you're going to blame it all on the mother, right? Well, that's what happened when I went to therapy. My mother said, you're going to blame it all on the mother. I said, hell yeah.
So did that cause some tension in the family?
Yes and no. I think my mother was proud of me and liked seeing my name up. And then when Ed Asner won his first Emmy for my script and he thanked me on television, that made everything okay.
You've been, well, in addition to writing scripts, you also have to pitch them. What's that process like?
Well, some people are good at it and some people aren't. Some writers, like my ex-husband, became a writer after had been a stockbroker. He didn't love pitching. So you get a partner who pitches.
And do you practice them?
Oh, yeah. You practice at least 10 times, I tell people. And then you practice in your car as you're driving to the studio and people think you're crazy talking to yourself. Yeah, you have to practice. And some people can't do it.
So they just don't succeed?
Well, they get another partner who can.
You've been involved in media for most of your life, in front of the camera, behind the scenes. You were on the talk show circuit a lot. Isn't that unusual for a TV sitcom writer?
Well, probably. I don't know. I did a lot of on-camera stuff. I would, like Good Day New York, I would go on and talk about, you know, things that upset me, like I do in my radio, things that I don't like. I make little lists. You know, if you can be funny in one genre, you can kind of be funny in another.
And if you succeed at it, then you get invited back, or other people want to have you on their show.
One hopes. So after this, everyone who wants me on the radio, please call.
Didn't you co-host the Bill Boggs show
once? I did. Back in the day, Bill was a wonderful guy who had a talk show, and I guessed it once or twice, and I would go on a trip, and then I would come back and be amusing, hopefully. And one time he had me guest.
But at the beginning of the book, you describe yourself as a nervous performer. How did you gain the confidence to co-host a talk show?
I was nervous if I was acting. I had the lead in my senior class play. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but I had an accident from nerves.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not good at being an actress, as I learned in the movies and stuff, but I can be myself very easily. So I can go on as a host or a guest, but I can't do lines and maintain a character.
Weren't you on the Stanley Siegel show for several episodes?
Stanley Siegel was a kind of neurotic, crazy guy in New York who used to, he lived on the air. You know, he had no life outside, and he would have his own therapist, and he would have his parents come on. So I came up with this great idea. I think the first reality thing where I would date him only on television. And the first time we had a little coffee setting, and the second time we had like a little drink. And then the third time, Sammy Kahn was playing The Party's Over. I said, oh, God, this guy's going to break up with me on television. He did. He broke up with me, saying that the relationship was making him nervous. The relationship didn't exist.
So you only learned about it on the air?
And the funny thing was, I was like, oh, my God. And afterward, I went to Bloomingdale's, and this little old lady came up to me and said, darling, you're too good for him.
So she had seen you in the show. Well, you clearly believe in firsthand research for your script assignments. Didn't you attend a singles weekend at a Catskills hotel at one point to do research?
I was doing a movie script from a book called The Girl That He Marries, and it was about a singles weekend. And I made the biggest mistake of my life. I went on the bad birthday, the bad birthday being 40. I'm now between 50 and death. But then I was 40, and I spent my 40th birthday at a singles weekend in the Catskills. Kill me now.
At the Concord or Grossinger's? You're not going to tell me?
I don't remember. It was so traumatic, I've blocked it out. I think it was the Concord.
You worked on a movie script based on that experience. Did it ever get made?
Nope. Another one on the shelf.
Now, do you understand why it didn't get made? Do you think that...
Because they're always looking for a reason to say no. They look at how many films are being made. You know, they give out, I'm going to make up a number. Let's say they do 200 assignments a year. They make 5 movies. And, you know, it's very difficult unless there's a star attached or whatever. And this was a really good book, and I had a really good producer, and it was a really good script. It got me a lot more work, but it didn't get made.
Do you think that you can ever pull one of those things out of a drawer and
update
it a bit?
I'm sure you could, but I've thought of it about one or two things that I really, really loved. I did a script for David Susskind in New York about a book called Orphan Jim, which was such a wonderful, wonderful book set in the Depression.
So you adapted it?
I adapted it, and when I got the job, he said, you know, what are your qualifications? I said, I'm always in a depression. And he thought that was funny. He and I had the same birthday. We became good friends. And it was a wonderful book about two orphans going across country, and a black maid adopts them. It's a fabulous book. I don't own the rights to it, and I don't even own the rights to my script anymore. But that one broke my heart, I have to tell you.
I'm speaking with Susan Silver, who has written a memoir called Hot Pants in Hollywood, Sex, Secrets, and Sitcoms. You write that Fear of Flying by Erica Jong was a touchstone for your generation. That book promotes sex as a conquest. Did you view sex that way?
I don't think that's what I got out of it. In fact, I was up to do the screenplay of that. I had a meeting for that, and I've gotten to know Erica now. I don't think it was about conquest. I think it was about freedom. I think it was about women talking about things they had never really talked about before.
But was that in Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby's Hollywood?
Well, I say, me too. There must be something about me. I'm not that gropable. I was only groped. I was involved with four of the five big gropers, and only one of them made a move. That was Cosby.
You mean working?
Yeah, I worked for Harvey Weinstein. I did a rewrite of a movie for him. He was just mean. Hmm. He didn't come on to me at all. And then
what would have happened if he had? I'm sure that because the casting couch is something that goes back to the earliest days of Hollywood.
You know, I think it's more for actors. I really do. As a writer, I've discussed this with my friends so many times. I have not had that happen to me. And maybe I got too big a mouth or something, or I was married a lot. I don't know why it didn't happen to me. I'm very glad it didn't, though. But I also think I would have just decked somebody. I hope I would have.
What did Cosby do?
When I was in college.
Can you tell this on the air?
I can. I was a little Jewish virgin in college, and there was a show called Hootenanny, mm-hmm. where they would come to college campuses and bring country western singers. And so a friend of my uncle's said, I have a client on the show. Would you like to come? If you sit in the front row and you're very animated, you'll be on television. And I said, oh, gosh, yes. So I went, and I was very animated, and he said, you did so well that you can sit through the second show, and you're invited to the cast party at Theodore Bakel's house. I said, how will I get there? He said, my client will take you. I said, who's your client? He said, Bill Cosby. And I didn't know who that was because he hadn't done anything yet, and I thought he was a country western singer. And so he got up on the stage, and he did a little bit of his routine. I said, oh, okay. And afterward, he took me to the party. He was very nice. At the party, I was very quiet. He seemed a little shy himself. On the way home, he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a comedy writer. And he said, well, would you like to work on my next album? I said, you're kidding. Yeah, would I ever? What would I have to do? Well, you know, we'll get together. We'll pitch ideas. I was like, oh, my God, this is so exciting. I was in college. I had a job already now. We got to my apartment, and he was in a little green sports car, and he lunged at me. And in my effort to get away, I said I did the Lucille Ball exit with my legs up in the air onto the curb, and he just drove off. I was so lucky, it would have ruined my life. Now, I told this story at my book party, and it was in page 6, and the next day someone called and they said, are you sitting down? I said, what, I'm being called into the case? What? They said, no, worse. The National Enquirer picked it up, and the headline was, Sitcom Vet Escapes Sex Fiend. I said, so glad my mother's not alive now to have seen that.
But you must have followed the trial very closely.
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, and I the whole thing is so awful, and given that now we know he had such a track record, I consider myself extraordinarily lucky because it would have ruined my life.
Getting back to your writing career, you quote your diary where you say you were bored always writing on the same themes, the insecure girl, the discrepancy between others' images of me and the image I have of myself. Do you think that your focus on your image is a result of a lifetime spent in media?
That's such an interesting question. I think because they say write what you know, number one. Number two, I thought in the beginning that you weren't allowed to make anything up, so I kept coming in with stories of my own life. And also, I write to connect with others, and I think only by revealing myself do I do that. And there's a quote in the book by Jean Moreau who talks about revealing yourself and being open, and I think that's why my work connects and why I feel good doing it, because it connects me to the world. I was an only child. I spent a lot of time by myself in my head.
You turned down opportunities to write for some popular shows, including Newhart, the second Bob Newhart show. Why? Had you just gotten bored doing
this? Oh, no. I would have loved doing that. They asked me to produce the second show, and I was very excited. And I went home that night, and I dreamt I was working on an assembly line in Detroit, like, or Lucy with the Chocolates. It was all coming too much, too fast. one of the reasons I became a writer was I didn't like to get up in the morning. I didn't want to get dressed and go to a job. And those jobs were 10 hours a day. So I turned it down.
Also, you got involved in politics. You were a certified FOB, a friend of Bill Clinton, and worked on his campaign. You also were an observer at the UN for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Are you surprised that Nikki Haley has resigned?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I have to say, when I retired from showbiz, I moved to New York. I was fortunate enough to take a year off, and I networked with a lot of people, and I met somebody who knew people at the Anti-Defamation League, and I got a job there running their speakers bureau, and then I worked for the Simon Wiesenthal Center as their UN observer. I find the Nikki Haley thing, at first I was encouraged. I thought she was going to come out and say, this is a charade and a farce and why I'm leaving, and she did just the opposite. I feel badly about it. The UN is a very problematic place, and particularly for me because I'm very positive about Israel, and it's not. But in general, I thought she was one of the good guys, and I guess she's not.
You have been hosting a weekly commentary show. Have you stopped writing for TV and the movies?
Yes, I stopped writing, years ago. After I retired in 89, we had a Writers Guild strike. And then I went into this other thing. Gary Marshall said I was a hyphenate. Usually it's producer slash writer, actor slash waiter. He said I was sitcom writer slash Nazi hunter. So that became my second career. And in the book, I talk about reinventing yourself, which I think you have to do every 20 years.
And you do a rather brief commentary on WHDD and the other Robin Hood stations in Sharon, Connecticut?
Yeah, I do a commentary on politics, media, and things that upset me called Oh, Come On.
Meanwhile, we also have this book, Hot Pants in Hollywood, Sex, Secrets, and Sitcoms, and soon to be released, the audiobook.
The Audible version will be available October 16th, but you can pre-order. You can't hear a sample, which is really annoying, until October 16th, but it sounds like me, because I do the narrating, so you'll like it, I promise.
And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Susan Silver, to Susie Stultz, who produced this segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and Jesse Lent, my assistant producer, who was at the audio controls today.
Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.